KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back with Stephen Herod Buhner in just a few minutes. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program. It's Mike Hagan. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, your imagination station. And good to be with you here tonight. We're going to start things off right off the bat here with my guest, Stephen Herod Buhner. But let me say a quick thank you to some of the people on the air before me. I sat in for Corey tonight doing the New Wave Radio Theater program, always an hour before this program at 10 o'clock. Before that, jazz plus blues equals the solstice moon. That's Kelvin and Kelvin tonight. Before that, tech radio, of course, all the guys keeping us up on the amazing world of new and high technology. And Jeff Wheeler starts things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Radio extraordinaire here on KOPN. It's a wonderful radio station, and it's a pleasure to be a part of it. All right. Thanks also to everyone who listened to the program last week. We featured musical selections from artists who've been featured on the program during the last year or so. And it was fun. I haven't had a chance to just play music for a while. Normally we're talking more than playing music. But anyway, that was great last week to showcase some of the stuff that we've heard over the last 15 months or so. Okay. All right. Anyway, it is the 24th of December. The Christmas Eve, for those of you who celebrate that particular tradition, and I hope you're enjoying the night regardless. Beautiful almost full moon, was full last night, and just some remarkable things happening in the heavens over the last few nights. Beautiful stuff up there, and I hope you've had a chance to go outside and gaze upward to take a look at some of the beautiful things happening up there in the stars above your heads, okay? All right, my guest tonight, his name is Stephen Herod Buhner. He has been on the program a couple, three times before. He's one of the favorite guests here among listeners of the program, and it's a pleasure to have Stephen back tonight. He is an award-winning author of books on nature, indigenous culture, the environment, herbal medicine. He comes from a long line of healers, including a former Surgeon General of the United States. The greatest influence on Stephen's work, however, has been his great-grandfather, who primarily used botanical medicines when he began working as a physician back in the early 1900s. Stephen's work has appeared or been profiled in publications throughout this planet. He lectures yearly all around the U.S. on herbal medicine, the sacredness of plants, intelligence in nature. He is a tireless advocate for the reincorporation of the exploratory artist, independent scholar, amateur naturalist, and citizen scientist into American society. And it is a pleasure and a privilege, as always, to say hello and welcome back to Radio Orbit, live and in person this time, Stephen Herod Buhner. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure, as always. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, as I was reading the introduction there, I thought again about your grandfather, and I haven't really, we really haven't spoken much about that part of your background. Maybe a couple of years ago when we talked initially, you told the story of A Taste of Wild Water, and we spoke a little bit about your great-grandfather. But maybe you could give us a little bit more background there, because it was such a formative set of experiences that led to the way you sort of view health care and healing today, and that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about tonight.
Yeah, well, you know, just as the older I get, too, I'm 55 now, so a lot of time has gone by, and the world's really moved on quite a bit from back then. And they really were from the 19th century, even though he died in 63, and my great grandmother died about 10 or 12 years later. I mean, the thing is, they were born when there was no electricity, and they used horses, and that kind of way of growing up. It was a much slower way of life and very different. So in spending that much time with him, I was really connected to a kind of a tradition that I think of as one of the best parts of American life, really. And that kind of slowness of pace and spending time with people and really looking at them and not being so interested in money, but being more interested in the profession that you'd been called to, and especially spending lengthy time in wilderness and in woods. And so that whole kind of dynamic made a huge difference.
What part of the country was that?
Oh, he was in southern Indiana is where he was. And my family had come over in the late 1700s, early 1800s into that region.
Mm-hmm. And did you grow up around there too?
Yeah, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, which is, I've gone back there, I can't even believe my DNA even stopped off there for a little bit, you know, it's like I don't fit there at all, but it was still the Ohio River Valley, and that kind of energy, you know, of Mark Twain and all of that sort of thing was still, in 52, there was that kind of rural dynamic that infused everything. It's very, very different than today.
Huh, amazing. Yeah, I've got family in Kentucky, actually, on my wife's side, and it's an interesting experience just to spend time down there. So
yeah, it's very different now, and you know, I still have a few phrases I use. Corner is the one instead of corner that, you know, everybody busts me on that one. But
that's funny. All right, so your grandfather was a doctor in a traditional sense, and he was primarily interested in plant medicines.
Well, you know, he was my great-grandfather.
Yes, that's right.
I tend to think of him like that, as my grandfather anyway, but
I call him all my grandfathers,
yeah,
though. Anyone who's gone before me, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, so, but, you see, he trained, and the training for a physician back there was very, very different. He did 3 years of college, and then he basically a year of apprenticeship, and then he began practice, and they had, antibiotics hadn't been discovered yet, and I think if the sulfa drugs had come in, they were just real new. And so in 1911, when he began practice, even though he was an allopathic physician, which is what we call doctors today, or the physicians we think of today are really allopathic physicians, and he used mostly botanic medicines. Almost everybody did back then. And then he also used mercury and a number of other things, more intensive, heroic-type medicines.
Huh.
But his primary medicinal basis was herbal medicines, and he made house calls. He really did start out with a horse and buggy and visited homes.
Huh.
And he made $5 a house call back then.
Amazing. All right, and much of what you sort of style your ideas on came from him, I guess.
Yeah, well, it was mostly the way he was. You know, I mean, that's one of the great problems in Western civilization, and I think it's worse in the United States more than any place else.
What do you mean?
That we always continually confuse form and essence over and over and over again, as if you can send somebody to medical school, which I think the training now is 14 years, somebody goes through that training for 14 years, then we sort of assume that they will get whatever that substance is that makes them a healer. And most of the people that go to physicians don't really enjoy it. But there was something in him that wasn't the form of his work. It was who he was and what he carried inside of him, this kind of way of being. He was tremendously empathic, and he was really called to the profession. And he trained in it before they went through that kind of 14 years of boot camp that kind of ground that impulse out of them. So that's what he was really known for. So it was not so much that he did medicine, but that he was a healer in a deeper sense, and that he carried that kind of deep empathy for the human condition, and he could really listen to people. So because I grew up, my parents were incredibly different than that, so the juxtaposition itself, it was that thing, that invisible thing he carried, that because there was so little of it in the rest of my life, that when after he died, and then I left home when I was 16, and I thought, you know, that's what I want. What is that thing that human beings can share that most human beings don't? That's what I want to have in my life all the time.
The description that you use of your great-grandfather sounds like a traditional medicine person, an indigenous healer. Would you say that there was a bit of that in him, perhaps?
Yeah, I really do think of him as a traditional kind of American healer, in the sense that there was that kind of blend. It was that simple Jeffersonian kind of close to the land sort of thing without a lot of pretension. And there's this kind of thread of energy, a lineage is one way I would think of it, that stretches back to the early days of this continent. And it's not just Native American influence, which is of course there, but there is this kind of simplicity of way of being that Americans kind of developed and carried for a long time that I think is pretty much lost now, but it was still alive. You know, there was still enough of it there when I was growing up that I could be touched by it and touch it. And in that sense, he really is and did carry kind of that traditional energy of healing that belonged uniquely to the American frontier.
Amazing. All right. Well, let's move forward. It's been 100 years, essentially, since that time. And medicine in the West, and that's a poor choice of words, actually, because when I think of the word medicine, I actually think of something that has to be good. In other words, medicine is a good word. There's no such thing really as bad medicine, in my opinion. There are people that practice healing and give people the wrong stuff, but I'd say that's not medicine. You know. But at any rate, there have been a tremendous amount of changes in the world and in the West since then, and a lot of it has become problematic. And you wrote this amazing paper called Healing Healthcare that you shared with me a few weeks ago, and I'd sort of like to to transition into that in some way here and start to talk about what you think happened in between.
Well, it's it really comes down to, like, there's, I have some, like, interesting kind of heroes, you know, in Deep Throat, the guy that talked to Bob Woodward and All the President's Men. He said a couple of great things that have stood me in great stead for a long time, and, you know, one of them was follow the money. And, you know, you know, then when you start following the money, everything starts to become more clear. And there was a thing that happened. Most people don't realize that in the United States in 1900, there were, I think, 7 different kinds of physicians that were practicing at that time. And the weakest of the group really were what we call doctors today, the allopathic physicians. There were a great deal more of them than the others, but the homeopaths actually were the dominant physician in the United States at that time, and they also had the best outcomes. And what happened was the American Medical Association made a deal with the pharmaceutical companies, and they began to accept advertising in the Journal of the American Medical Association for pharmaceutical drugs, and their income for lobbying went tremendously high in an incredibly short period of time, into the millions of dollars, and they begin to use that money to lobby for control of health care, and they eventually got it. And the last herbal medical college that licensed herbal physicians closed in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1936, and that pretty much was the end of it. And we went into this tremendous transition where there was this alliance between allopathic physicians and pharmaceutical companies, and they gained control over the entire healthcare field in the United States. And ever since then, it's gotten worse and worse and worse. It was pretty much where we've ended up today. It was pretty much inevitable once that happened.
Has it been the same case around the planet for the most part, or is this?
No, it's really kind of weird, you know, because the United States is, like, held out as this great democracy and home of entrepreneurial capitalism.
Yeah, everybody thinks we have the best health care.
We spend more on health care than anybody else on Earth, okay, than any other culture per capita. And our outcomes are one of the poorest for the industrialized nations. I mean, one of the things that's fascinating to me in Michael Moore's film Sicko, you know, it showed that the United States is number 37 on healthcare outcomes, and Cuba's like 39 or something like that, and they're just one spot away practically. And the thing is, they spend about $250 per person per year on healthcare. We're something in 10 or 20,000, I don't even remember, but we spend the most. And so the thing is, they're getting the same outcome in terms of health and life expectancy that we are, and spending the least of many countries on Earth. So, you know, we have a real problem here, and we don't have the best healthcare system on Earth. That's kind of just the advertising that's, you know, convinced everybody about that. But it's not the case, never been the case, never going to be the case. So in any event, what's really interesting is that in countries like when Mao took over China, he didn't like the westernization of medicine, and he's the one that institutionalized Chinese medicine as kind of an option to that. He wanted to keep that traditional health care. And what's really interesting is that Adolf Hitler did the same thing in Germany, which is why Germany has one of the strongest integrated botanical medicine traditions in Europe.
Isn't that amazing?
And it's always been kind of weird to me that these people that were totalitarian dictatorships have the most freedom in healthcare, whereas we have a totalitarian healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. How does it relate to this first experience that you talk about in that paper where and I'd like you to tell it maybe to the audience when you were arrested for the first time, and this is a sort of experience.
Oh, I was arrested basically, you know, people get arrested now for driving while black. I was arrested for, you know, walking with long hair, you know. I was in Texas in the 60s, and so they took me to jail, and then they said, oh, well, you know, searched me. They were quite unkind about it, and they said, oh, you know, you're never going to get out. They didn't really tell me you know, what I was charged with, what I'd done wrong. And
sound familiar?
You know, they said, oh, we called your mother, but she, you know, she's never going to get you. And I said, well, I want a phone call. I want to call a lawyer. They said, oh, you don't have any rights to a lawyer. We're not going to let you have a phone call and all of this stuff. And eventually, you know, it turned out that, you know, they had called my mother, and they just kind of thought, oh, well, we'll just, you know, kind of scare him because, you know, then he'll straighten up. And the thing is that it did one thing for me, that's for sure, is that I've hated the abuse of power ever since. And I'm very sensitive to that kind of abuse of power and the kind of hypocrisy that's behind, oh, we have this great constitution and everything, but when it comes to practice, there's something wrong between the theory and practice, some disconnect. And we see that a lot more now with Guantanamo and all of the stuff that's going on there. So when I moved into the world, that's something that's always motivated me tremendously, is that sensitivity to the abuse of power. And within the healthcare system, there's a tremendous abuse of power. I mean, people tend to think that physicians and hospitals are there to heal or to help the sick. That's not why they're there. They're there to make money. And that's it. And that's why follow the money is such an important precept. They're not there to help. And people in the United States, it's not uncommon for people in, at the end of their life to end up spending everything that they have just to pay for their health care. If they have cancer or they need chemotherapy or something like that, it's about the money. And because I believe in the importance of human beings creating their own kind of self-sustaining culture, it doesn't make sense to have a top-down medical system in which a few people get very rich for outcomes that are extremely poor. I mean, nobody else would be able to get away with the kind of outcomes these guys get away with routinely every day. We'd all, if it was an herbalist was producing those outcomes, they'd be in jail a long time ago.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those outcomes. What does the research or the data show us about the success of these types of procedures?
Well, for, you know, probably I think one of the most telling pieces is the, and the Journal of the American Medical Association a number of years ago published an article, and this is, you have to realize, is extremely unusual for them to publish something this damning about their system, and that was that properly prescribed pharmaceuticals are the fourth leading cause of death in the United States.
Properly prescribed?
Properly prescribed. Over 100,000 people a year die from the pharmaceuticals their doctors prescribe them. 1.2 million of them are either hospitalized or permanently disabled by those same pharmaceuticals.
My gosh.
So, and, you know, if an herbal, if herbalists were producing those kind of outcomes, we'd all be in jail a long time ago. But nevertheless, everybody just goes, oh, huh, well, I guess that's the price we pay for the best healthcare system on earth. But, you see, herbal medicines, which are consumed about at one-third the rate of pharmaceuticals in the United States, statistical analysis has shown at most one person per year dies from properly prescribed herbal remedies.
Amazing.
So it's a tremendously safe way of healing, a tremendously safe approach. And what's more, there's a tremendous amount of data showing how incredibly effective it is. Nevertheless, the continual kind of information that shows up in newspapers is that, oh, this is untested, oh, it's, you know, uncertain, oh, you know, it might not be safe. Whereas the thing that's really killing most of the people is the pharmaceuticals that everybody assumes are safe.
And the FDA is just an enabler as far as this thing goes, apparently.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, that's, you know, I lobbied for 5 years in Colorado about alternative health care issues. And the way the system works is extremely dysfunctional. And, you know, any kind of a group that is formulated to oversee any kind of profession, it doesn't matter what it is, but healthcare is the perfect example of it. The people that form the boards all end up having close ties to the groups that are being regulated, and it's a very incestuous kind of situation. They don't, they're not really there for protecting the health of the consumer. They're not really, they're really there because it's a power game, and that's really what it's about.
Yeah, I know there are many of the executives at the FDA that are former executives at pharmaceutical companies and this sort of thing. There's quite of a revolving door sort of idea going on with many of these people.
And that's true. And the other thing is, it's just in the nature of human beings to form power cliques. They just do that. So, you know, even in the alternative health field over the last 20 years, there's been a greater and greater movement toward that exact same kind of process. It doesn't matter whether it's the American Botanical Council, who's supporting herbal medicine, or the American Herbalist Guild. They all tend to move in that same kind of power dynamic, going more and more toward supporting control for a small group of people rather than practiced by the general population of healing dynamics that really come out of the grassroots, from the bottom up, from the people themselves. There isn't a lot of power invested in people in the United States over their own health, and it's important for it to remain that way if they want to keep making the kind of money that they are.
Yeah, because the idea is that you as an individual cannot, and it's dangerous if you try, to take care of yourself.
Yeah, I know. And that's one of the most amazing things that continually comes up if you read much in this field, which I do. There's always that kind of little warning in there, like, oh, you can't really trust yourself. Oh, you're kind of stupid, you know. Oh, you won't be able to figure it out. You really need these really smart people, us, the doctors, to really help you. And that is an incredibly anti-democratic principle, that entire thinking. And also, it's just not sustainable. The United States can't sustain, and no Western country can sustain, this kind of health care. There's a number of reasons for it, but the system itself is not sustainable. And even just one aspect of that is all of the pharmaceuticals that are made are highly dependent on the petrochemical industry.
Right, right. Many of them,
many of them are made directly. The majority are made directly from petroleum.
Isn't that strange? I mean, I think people probably are amazed by that who've never heard it before, because you think, well, you know, why is oil, you know, something that would be based in a, or
because
something that's supposed to be medicinal?
Because it's from plants.
Everything's from plants.
Everything's from plants. I mean, you can make a mechanical horse. You can't make mechanical spinach that's going to do you any good. You know, our whole foundation is on the plant world, and so plants are the primary creators of chemical compounds on this planet. They're the best chemists that ever have been, ever will be, and each plant will make, you know, up to 2,000 different chemical constituents for the various things it's involved in, and that's where all of these compounds come from. They're discovered in there, so they go to a raw resource base like petroleum, and then they begin to make, use them as a building block to make these compounds. So, but the hospitals, the transportation to the hospitals, all of the tubing, everything in there, except for a very few number of things, are dependent on the petroleum industry. And as we hit more and more peak oil problems, that stuff is going to get more and more expensive, more and more difficult to get. And it's just not a sustainable system. And the other thing, which, you know, I wrote about a lot in my book, Lost Language of Plants, which most people have never really thought about, is that pharmaceutical medicines are, for the most part, not biodegradable.
They go right back into the environment. In many cases, much of the stuff that goes into your body goes through you without even being metabolized, right?
Right. And so we excrete it out. That's why we have to take these medicines many times throughout the day and continually. It raises the level of the drug in our body. Our bodies essentially go, oh, my God, what the heck is that? So we excrete it out because it's not useful. It just, it kind of forcibly shifts our functioning while it's in there. We excrete it out. Our functioning goes back to the way it was before we took the pharmaceutical. So we take more to kind of keep that state. It's like we force our body to become different. We don't heal the underlying condition, but we rather force the symptom picture to shift. And so these things that we then excrete out, they go into the wastewater stream where they pretty much stay unaltered. There's some wastewater plumes that have been being studied and followed for over 20 years, and the drugs are just as active now as they were back then.
Yeah, it's remarkable, and they're just all over the place.
They are. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of millions of tons of this stuff going into the environment every year.
Unbelievable. All right, look, Stephen, that's a good place to take a little break, okay?
Yep.
All right, let's do that. We'll come back, everybody, with Stephen Herod-Buhner in just a moment here. Stephen's website is on the web at www.gaianstudies.org, and that's G-A-I-A-N-S-T-U-D-I-E-S, gaianstudies.org. It's a fantastic website, lots of information there that Stephen shares with you. His most recent couple of books, and he's written a number of them, are, I guess, The Secret Teachings of Plants and Healing Lyme. Do you have anything, Stephen, that's come out since your Lyme disease book that I've missed?
Yeah, I did one that just came out after that on natural health care for testosterone levels in men. It's looking at how endocrine disruptors in the environment affect male testosterone levels.
And you've written a book called Vital Man, I think, that's a great book for men's health.
Right, yeah.
Okay. All right, we'll come back in just a moment, okay? All right, everybody. Like I said, Stephen Herod-Buhner on the web at gaianstudies.org. And you can link over there from my site over at mikehagan.com. I'd also give you a heads up to go over to the archives sometime, perhaps after this program, and download any of the programs that Stephen has participated in before this one. There's a show from, I guess, April of last year with Dennis McKenna, that's a very popular program. Stephen and I talked about a year ago about one of his books called Sacred Plant Medicine, and we spoke a couple, 3 years ago about The Lost Language of Plants and a number of other books that he's written. But great stuff coming from Stephen Herod-Buhner, and has been doing it for a long, long time. We'll come back with Stephen in just a minute. In the meantime, this is The Starlings. By the way, we're hearing music from a band called The Starlings tonight, featured from a disc called Songbook. Great music here. And we'll continue with the song called Hand to Mouth. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia.
Tell me a story about when you hit the road. Tell me a story when it's like to grow so old. Well, I know you've been.
Help myself, I don't know.
that's Hand to Mouth. More music from the Starlings. Great stuff coming from Kansas City way. Appreciate the music. Thanks for sharing that with us. And I'd like to say hi to everybody in the chat room and everybody listening to the program tonight over the traditional airwaves or over the internet. Pleasure to have all you with us. Stephen, we've got people listening from Eastern Europe right now over the web. We got people all over the United States. Got some friends in Oregon who say, I got the whole family listening to Orbit tonight. My mom loves Stephen's work.
Oh, that's great.
So anyway, it's fun doing the live programs because we get a whole lot of interaction from people that are listening all around the place. And I appreciate you sticking around and staying up late to talk with us a little bit tonight.
You're welcome.
All right, everybody, it is Stephen Herod-Buhner on the web at GaianStudies.org, and we will get right back to him. Stephen, the word prostitution is one that plays a pretty heady role in this paper that I'm so interested in that you wrote. People would think that maybe that's not related to healthcare, except maybe by sexually transmitted diseases or something. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I tend to follow serendipity wherever it leaves. There's these uncommon experiences that come into all of our lives that I think are the things that lead us to the life that we're meant to live, you know, if we're willing to follow those things.
Right, I agree.
And, that's one of the reasons I don't think people should be forced to read the great classics. People should be able to skim and find what jumps out at them. And this is how this kind of all started for me about prostitution, the way you're talking about. I was picked up an issue of Harper's Magazine, which I love, and they had a little excerpt from a book called A Woman Whose Calling Is Men. And I started reading this thing, and it was one of the most powerful pieces of writing I've read in a long time. And this woman just had this tremendously raw, impactful power in her work, and it was just maybe, gosh, a half a page excerpted from her book. And she was somebody who decided at about the age of 35 to become a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't make any money. She had two children. She wasn't getting any child support. And she decided to do this. And it turned out that this was her calling in her work. And she really loved it. And so all the stuff she was saying about prostitution, it's like it didn't match any of the pictures that I had, because I'd gotten most of my information about it from television or from the internet or from newspapers. And so I kind of started, this intrigued me so much, I started reading into it more. I read her book, and it was really fascinating. And then I came across this other book by a woman named Laura Maria Augustin called Sex at the Margins, that I just kind of happened on that, you know, a few weeks later.
Uh-huh.
And I read this thing, and she had taken an anthropological approach to studying prostitution. And what she found out was really fascinating. She found out that about 80 to 90% of the prostitutes that in the world, in every culture that she met, they entered the profession by choice.
Huh.
Okay, it wasn't because they were forced to, or because they were drug addicts, or because they did it from choice. And nearly all of those same ones experienced a rise in self-esteem. Their income levels rose. Their education levels rose. Their sense of self-worth rose. And when they were asked about it, they said, no, we really like the profession. This is what we want to do. And, you know, of course, this completely flies in the face of everything that all of us have kind of absorbed about what prostitution is. And these women are all very clear about it, is that one of the major things that there's probably two major things they don't like about the status of things about prostitution. One is that it's illegal, and the second is they dislike abolitionist feminists in the extreme.
Huh.
You know, because what's fascinating is I got into it, there's this whole movement through feminism and through much of kind of the liberal New Age dynamics that, you know, prostitution is a ill treatment of women. It's viewing them as a thing, as a sexual object, and
it's really
bad for them, and they all need to not do this, and it's only circumstances that create it. But when you actually look at the real data from the field, what's really true, what you find out is that those assertions are incorrect. There's very, very few women that end up in that position because they're forced to, because they're drug addicts, because they're run by pimps. There's very few of them that experience it as abuse, are, you know, negatively impactful on their self-esteem. And what's fascinating is that when abolitionist feminists are people that are active against prostitution, if that data is brought up to them, then they basically say, well, those people can't, because of their experiences, they can't make informed choices.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, we have to make it for them. Uh-huh. They have to be saved in spite of themselves.
Right, that's always dangerous.
And so this kind of opened up a way of thinking about something that had been troubling me for a very long time, whether you're looking at the prohibition of tobacco or you're looking at the semi-prohibition of alcohol or whether you're looking at the licensure laws for medicine or Mothers Against Drunk Driving. It doesn't. There's this kind of theme that's been running through everything for, you know, as long as I've been around, but it's getting more and more pronounced now, which is we all have to be protected from ourselves by all of these groups that know better, and our choices are being curtailed considerably. And as I looked into it, I realized finally what this whole dynamic was, and I've been thinking about this for quite a long time, is it's really the shadow side of the liberal left, and it's actually what it is matriarchalism. It's the companion piece to the patriarchal movement. And,
right.
You know, you hear people, somebody says, oh, that's very patriarchal. Everybody kind of knows what that means. But they mean it that there's this kind of shadow side of the male, that there's this kind of misuse of the male power. And this other dynamic that I'm talking about here, it's the misuse of the feminine, the misuse that you see that runs the shadow side in the left. So that thing, when you start getting into healthcare, that dynamic starts to play a very huge part when you start talking about healthcare. And the second thing that I thought was really fascinating about the whole prostitution issue is it showed how so many people take on certain assumptions about things, and even if an examination of what's really true shows that their perspectives aren't accurate, they still don't want to let go of them.
Hmm.
So, for instance, when you go into healthcare and you start to find data that shows that there's very little relationship between education and competence as a physician, okay, that there's very little relationship between those years of training and their ability to do the work that they're supposedly in profession to do, that's something that's very hard for people to see, because we all assume that those years of training produce a better physician, a better healer, that licensure actually protects the public, which it doesn't, that continuing education credits help physicians keep on top of things and remain educated, which they don't. So many of the assumptions that people have going into healthcare when they're looking at what are we going to do with all of this, how can we make it better, how can we make, you know, get coverage for everybody, most of the assumptions that which are being in place, that are in place as people approach it, they're just inaccurate. So therefore, the outcomes we're going to get aren't going to be accurate. They're not going to be good outcomes.
Right. Yeah, the assumption that because somebody had the training or went to school for this, that, or the other thing, and not just in healthcare, but in many, many fields.
Everybody knows, everybody knows, that you have to end up, when you graduate from school and you go in the field, you have to forget most of what you learned and start to learn what's really true when you're in the field working with stuff. You can't learn this stuff in books. You can't learn it in classrooms. You can't learn it in laboratories. The primary number one criteria that's crucial for a healer is empathy, okay? And that is the one thing they don't teach. And as a matter of fact, it's the one thing they do their best to make sure that the students have no capacity for. They train them out of that.
Yeah, that's remarkable, actually. Do physicians still take the Hippocratic Oath?
They do still take it. I don't think any of them really believe it, but they do still take it, because if they were going to first do no harm, they would have an entirely different approach to the whole thing.
Right, it's sort of like it's taken as not as seriously, perhaps, as it probably should be, huh?
Well, it's a funny thing about the time that we're in. You know, that's one of the things I've seen, the belief amongst the general population that honor and integrity are a critical part of a human character is much weaker now than I've ever seen it in my life, and the belief that money the amount of money you have is the most important thing, is much stronger than I've ever seen. And those things are not compatible with healing. They just aren't.
Right. And there's been a direct correlation between those two things, as you mentioned, for quite a long time now.
For quite a long time, and it gets worse every year. I mean, you know, the studies, you know, all of the studies are out there. I mean, that's one of the things that's fascinating to me as well, you know, that there's been hundreds, if not thousands, of studies analyzing what's wrong with healthcare. Nevertheless, nothing's being done to change it. Like, physicians have an average of 7 minutes or something per patient. That's absurd. Anybody knows it's absurd. Everybody knows it's absurd. Anybody even thinking about it knows it's absurd. And nevertheless, that's less than what they had 10 years ago, what they have 12 minutes 10 years ago.
That's amazing.
So it's not stopping. It's in fact getting worse. And that's one of the reasons why the alternative health movement has blossomed so much in the United States, because people want alternatives to that, and so outlaws begin creating options.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is herbalism and homeopathy and all this.
Yeah, in the 1960s, Rosemary Gladstar, who was in California, she's pretty much considered to be the godmother of American herbalism, of this kind of resurgence of it, and she was primarily responsible for bringing herbalism back to kind of the whole hippie stuff that was happening in California, and from there it began spreading all around the United States.
Huh.
And there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people have trained in herbal medicine since the mid-1960s, and it was really people in the whole midwifery movement that started, and body work, and many of the psychotherapy movements, all of those things came out of this whole sort of hippie, anti-establishment, back-to-the-land movement.
Mm-hmm.
That has gained massive inertia, and it's sort of being absorbed into the primary system now, but that's not where it started.
Right. You know, you mentioned that physicians spend a very short amount of time typically with their patients in the allopathic AMA setup, you know, in the hospitals and these places. Could you talk a little bit about holistic medicine and what it means and why it would take more time, in other words, to get to know what's really wrong or how to help somebody?
Well, with most of the people, it's actually changing quite a bit now, but I'll talk as if it were the way it used to be.
Uh-huh.
And most of the people that went into alternative medicine did so because they truly felt called to the profession, and that they really felt that they didn't want anything to do with sort of an allopathic approach. They truly wanted to help heal people. And it's not uncommon for those people to spend, you know, anywhere from 40 minutes to 2 hours with a patient that's come to see them, especially if it's a new patient. And they learn to see the person from inside that person's world. It's like one of the things that Cuban physicians do. They have a remarkable kind of situation there in which there's one physician for every 2,000 people, one physician and one nurse, and they live in that area. It's kind of broken up geographically, and
mm-hmm.
they spend time going to all of the people's homes because they see the environment in which the person lives, and that environment gives rise to kind of the unique person that's there in many ways, so that they see how that environment influences their health, whether it's the physical environment or the emotional environment of the family. And it's that kind of knowledge. The more knowledge that you have, the more you know them and as a human being, and when you're being part of their community, the more you can actually help them. And most physicians and people in this country are strangers. They never have the time to get to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a huge difference. And what's even more than that, the person that is ill, they have a suffering, you know, and they come to you for help, and they need to know that you're really receiving that suffering, that you're hearing them, that you're seeing them, and that you genuinely care. And
mm-hmm.
that, mm-hmm. and there, you know, there's, I mean, only in the United States would we have to spend a lot of money to do hundreds of studies to find out that caring is a crucial part of healing.
Yeah, it seems, should be a little bit more self-evident, you know?
You know, I remember, Liz, I was fortunate enough to study with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross years ago, and she told this remarkable story about how She was working in Denver, Colorado with terminal cancer patients, and a lot of the patients that shouldn't be getting well were getting well. She'd come back in the morning, and they'd be substantially better. You know, she was like, this is really strange. And so she began to lurk around the hospital at night trying to figure out what was happening. And she was noticing after a while that a member of the janitorial staff was spending a lot of time in those patients' rooms.
Right.
So she catches up with the woman, and she goes, one night she goes, excuse me, what are you doing with my patients? And the woman's kind of freaked out and said, nothing, you know, and starts to scurry off. And Elizabeth says, no, I'm not mad, I just need to know what you're doing. And the woman turns around and looks at her and says, they're dying, you know. I just sit there with them and hold their hands.
Oh, man.
It's really hard to die without love. It's really hard even to live without love. And then she just turned around and walked off.
Amazing.
And Elizabeth said, in that moment, I knew that the most important thing in healing is invisible. And that thing, that invisible thing, they don't teach in school. It took the lowest person in the hospital, the lowliest employee, who knew something none of them knew. And that thing, that capacity to sit with somebody, to hear their story, to take into yourself their suffering, and to give a response out of genuine caring, that's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
The medicines and all of that, they're just supportive, and they come out of that thing. And that's the thing my great-grandfather did over and over and over again, the thing that he taught me without ever saying it, that was the most important thing. And so that's what many of the alternative people were trying to bring back into health care.
Mm-hmm. And you said that in the schooling of the typical allopathic physician, that's actually sort of bred out of them. In other
it's
words,
destroyed.
Even if people go in there with good intention, with empathy, with love, by the time the 14 years is up, they're probably beaten to a pulp and they've been... that's been removed, or at least that's by design, at least. Huh?
It's like going through a tremendously difficult boot camp for a long time, and I've had physicians train with me and study with me because they can't recover from that. The last one that worked with me, she said, I've been suffering post-traumatic stress disorder ever since I graduated.
Hmm.
And I had a friend when I grew up, his entire family all became physicians, and he was a really sweet guy, and he held on to some of that after he became a doctor. But I mean, one of the first things they did was they go to the pound and they get dogs, right? And they bring the dogs to the training hospital where this guy was, the school, and then they drained their blood out of these living dogs, okay, until they died. And they did it so they could see what, how blood failure affected the life processes toward death. How can you, you know, and how could you do that? I mean, I just don't see how somebody could do that to dogs and animals like that and expect to have this capacity for empathy and caring still intact. And as a matter of fact, most of them don't have it intact. Plus, then they start working as interns and they're working, what, 30, 40, 50 hours straight sometimes.
Right, right.
It doesn't, everybody knows, every study has shown how debilitating and dangerous that is. Nevertheless, they don't stop it. They're not going to stop it.
Yeah, and in fact, the whole thing is interpreted as good. Well, they're working a lot of hours and very hard, and it's very, you know, as if this is somehow beneficial to both, to everybody involved, the physician included.
Yeah, most of the physicians I've talked to that are kind of new ones basically feel that the whole point of that is to break down the personality of the student so that it can be remade in the image that their teachers desire. And very much like Army boot camp.
Right,
and that thing doesn't make any sense. You know, in all of the years I've worked as a practitioner or as a teacher for people, there's the slow accumulation of knowledge based on kind of a relationship with mentors that you work with, who carry kind of the moral values of healing. They carry that capacity for caring and empathy, and by example and also sharing in that process, you learn it from them.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to have rest, and you need to have time for contemplation, and you need to have time to sit with the people that come to you to understand the suffering so that you can legitimately help them. And what's more, you have to do your own work mm-hmm. on yourself. I mean, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was really clear. She said, you can't be a physician, you can't be any good unless you can take time to also work on your own stuff, because when you're dealing with the dying and you're dealing with the ill, stuff comes up. It's just the way that it is.
Right. You know, there's that old adage that says, physician, heal thyself.
Yeah, there is.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe you could just riff on that for a second, because it seems like that's the first order of business, is to sort of take care of your own stuff.
And that's been kind of my approach from the beginning, but I was really lucky in a lot of ways. I had that kind of core of my great-grandfather's experience when I started out, but more, it was the 60s. I had a place to go. There was a kind of a dream that was going on then that people could find some purchase in for their spirits. And so I began not from the concept of making a living or money, but I began with the concept of that I'm involved in a human journey, part of which involves healing. And so looking at my own healing, that became a crucial part of it. And that's how most of my knowledge about plant medicines has arisen. Most of the techniques and capacities I've trained in and understood came from my own process of working on healing myself. And there's certain people then now that find me that know I'm for them. I talk about the long bag of shadow that we all drag behind us. It's a Jungian term that I picked up from Robert Bly.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has to at some time stop and turn around and open the long bag of shadow they mm-hmm. drag behind them and begin to eat that shadow, to reincorporate the parts of themselves that they've abandoned that are ill because of it. And in doing that, the person that's involved in healing, they know the territory of illness because they themselves have traveled there. And when a client comes to somebody like that, they know that you've eaten something they haven't. And they know you can walk into that dark place unafraid, and they need that. And healers really need to engage in that process to be good at their work.
Mm-hmm.
They have to.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. You know, let me ask you one more thing before the top of the hour here. You mentioned this idea of bleeding dogs out, which is just so offensive to me. But it's not just the dog. I mean, it's anything. It's rats and whatever. And I'd like to ask you a question just, I guess, in general about respect for life. Because apparently there seems to be, for some people at least, a line that you draw somewhere, and above that line, apparently, you know, you cannot harm that creature or that animal. But below that line, wherever it is, and it's drawn in different places for different people, you know, below the line, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, it's one of the core issues that we're struggling with in our time as a species now. I think every time has its own particular challenges. And that's one of ours, and I think it comes directly from the fact that we've been trained from the moment we go to school that everything in the universe around us is not intelligent, not very sentient, it has no soul, no capacity for self-awareness or self-direction. So we end up thinking...
Except for us, right?
Except for us, that we're the only intelligent life form on a ball of resources hurtling around the sun. And you know, James Hillman, who I really respect, he had a great point about that. He said it was only when science convinced us that the world was dead that they could begin their autopsy in earnest.
Mm-hmm.
And basically we have been engaged in the dissection of the world. Scientists do it for knowledge, supposedly, though actually most of them do it for profit. And big corporations, they do resource extraction for profit. So we're just now kind of innocent bystanders in this process, and our job is to consume. You know, the whole concept of that is as a nation of people that have the capacity for reason and thinking to create our own destiny together, to create our own health care together, to take care of each other. You know, I mean, what would it be like if as children went to school, instead of being taught home ec and shop, they were taught herbal medicine and how their body works and self-body care and how to take care of their family, 90% of the weight on the healthcare system in the United States would be gone.
Amazing.
Because people would be doing it themselves. They could grow their medicines in their own backyards. And if whatever was wrong was beyond their capacity, then there would be somebody in their community who knew more that they would go to. So it would take a long time before you even got to a hospital or a specialist who was involved in very complicated processes. And 90% of the people could take care of their own needs that way. It would be very inexpensive, very sustainable, very little need for pharmaceuticals.
Hmm. Well, that may be something that... that comes whether people like it or not.
I believe it is going to come whether people like it or not, just as different housing will come and different agriculture and different transportation. The system we have is crumbling under its own weight.
All right. Stephen, would you like to stick around for one more segment? We got a bunch of questions here and a lot more things to talk about if you've...
Long is another segment?
Oh, another half an hour or so?
I'll do a half hour.
All right, cool. Let's do that. We'll give you a little break. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes. I'll play a piece of music here, and then we'll come back and talk for another half hour, okay?
Great.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Stephen Herod-Buhner on the web at GaianStudies.org. Stephen's got a lot of wonderful books, all worth reading as far as I'm concerned, and certainly someone whose words I really appreciate, and I hope you're listening in tonight. And when this is up on the web, in the archives, maybe you can download it and share it with your friends, okay? All right, it's Mike, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. One more time, the Starlings, and this song is called Bones to Ashes. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Stephen Herod-Buhner. The Starlings. That's called Bones to Ashes. Big thank you to Joy for sending me this wonderful CD and sharing it with you all tonight. Okay, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM on the web at www.kopn.org. You can always listen to the radio station live here in mid-Missouri, 40,000 watts on the FM dial, and also streaming live on the Internet. And you can listen to the program anywhere on the planet as long as you've got a decent web connection, okay? All right. Speaking of Internet, the website for my guest tonight, Stephen Herod Buhner, is www.guyanstudies.org. And as always, you can link there directly from my site at mikehagan.com, okay? All right. Back now to Stephen Herod Buhner. Hi, Steve.
Hey.
Hey, the shadow. There's a shadow behind everything, apparently, and you talk a lot about the shadow in the healthcare industry, but you also mentioned in the previous bit of talking that we did about our own personal shadows and that those have to be confronted as well. Are they the same, or are they connected?
Well, they're definitely connected. I mean, we all have our individual shadows. We have shadows that come from our family, shadows from our, you know, local town where we live, shadows from our state, our country, and our species even. So these things are really cumulative. And, you know, I mean, just a very simplistic one is in the United States, it's very common for people to hear phrases like, oh, this is the best country in the world, or things like that, you know, we're the democratic people. And because of that belief that's so firmly entrenched there, it's very difficult for the citizenry of the country to see the shadow that's there that can easily come out in times of fear or great stress, like after 9/11, this whole kind of dynamic, the suspension of habeas corpus and all of that, that's been in our culture but not acknowledged as a shadow for a long time. And when a thing is in the shadow, it's very easy for it to come out and take on form and affect things because there's a lack of self-awareness, and so as a result, a kind of a denial or a fooling of the self. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Germany could go from the most developed, sophisticated nation on earth to the one of the most oppressive in just a few short years, get to the place where they had concentration camps and could kill, you know, over 5 million Jews. So it doesn't take long if the shadow's not acknowledged. So it is a real problem that the West has. Europe's a little better at it now because of that, but it's not present in the healthcare system much at all. And amongst the liberal left, of which I've been a member ever since, you know, I was old enough to go from home,
right,
it's still a real problem to see this in the community of people that I feel I belong to. Nevertheless, they don't examine the kind of motives that influence their behavior, that influence the kind of laws that they're instituting. So we just get on this cycle of unconsciousness, really, that causes tremendous problems.
Do you see, this is just a question off the cuff that this comes to me, but do you see something happening there? In other words, it seems that the unconscious part of our mind is very problematic at this point. Do you see that changing? In other words, are we moving towards a state in an evolutionary idea that, you know, we may be having to somehow become fully conscious, where we can't afford to have that unconscious part of our mind?
Well, we certainly can't afford it. Whether or not we'll be able to do something constructive about it is a real question. I mean, that there's so much knowledge and awareness of Vietnam was still in this country, yet we could immediately go into a circumstance in Iraq that was virtually identical with the same kind of reasoning and unclarity and have so many people in the country be supportive of it without thought. And that includes a tremendous number of people on the left. So it's a difficult kind of situation. And that's part of the reason why, after working very hard, more sort of in a mainstream way after years and years, I just kind of began to follow my feelings about where it seemed I was meant to be and to go and the things I was meant to say, and in a way to start to preach to the choir more, because it's like that song that the choir sings, that as it gets louder and more people join in, it begins to change things on its own. I don't think that the system itself is going to be willing to change from the inside at all.
I agree with you. And feeling, I'd like to talk about that again. This is a thread that runs throughout most of your work that I've read. You concentrate and, or at least give a high value for people to actually consider what they're feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. I mean, we're not computers. We're not calculating machines. And yet we're trained more and more often all the time to believe the only part of us that's legitimate is our brains, the part that thinks. But the higher brain functions that we have, all it is simply an organic computer. It's an analytical processing machine, but it's not where we live our lives as human beings. And that's, you know, again, one of the reasons why the kind of healthcare training that occurs in this country for the most part is so absurd, because it's focused mostly on mentation and very little on feeling. And it's that empathy is a feeling process. I mean, to be able to look at another human being and understand their suffering and to respond in such a way that that person feels like they have companionship in that suffering, it's not something that happens through the brain. It happens through the heart, through the capacity to feel. And that is crucial. Nevertheless, you know, and it's funny, you know, I see people all the time that are quite successful, and then they come to study with me or other people, and they go, something's wrong, you know, with my life. And they try to go back to feeling, but they haven't really had much experience with it in 30 or 40 years, and so their brain is absurdly farther ahead. It's very difficult to reclaim that capacity. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it is the most essential part of what it means to be a human being.
Amazing. All right, let me ask you one more here before we get a few from the crowd. The idea of oral tradition compared to the literary world, do you think that that's a significant factor in this?
I'm not quite following the question, actually.
Well, okay, the healthcare, the way that it's practiced is primarily through books and...
I tend to think it's more theory versus apprenticeship in your question that you're talking about.
That's actually probably a better way to phrase it, yeah.
The apprenticeship is an extremely crucial process for, you know, when I was going to school, I didn't really fit in the boxes of school very well.
Oh, really? I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, and so what I did was I decided to do a university without walls, and I... made a list of all of the people that had moved me as a human being, and they were the ones I went and studied with, like Elizabeth Kubler Ross or Buckminster Fuller or different people that had done these amazing things. And I sort of created my own kind of apprenticeship with these amazing people, and that's what apprenticeships were, that kind of learning. There's a transmission that occurs. They carry something invisible inside of them, and there's other people in new generations that are meant for that thing to be passed into so that they carry it on, and then in their time they pass it on into someone else.
Right.
And that is what the lineage of healing or teaching or writing or whatever it is that you want to look at, that's where it really happens.
Mm-hmm.
When you just go to books and you think, wow, we can test everybody and then everybody will be really good, it's not true, because the essential core of the thing, that living tradition that's passed on from one person to another generation after generation, it doesn't generally happen in that kind of educational system that's been set up.
Okay. All right. Mike, can you get Stephen to give us his definition of Gaia?
Gaia, that's really interesting. Right? To me, there's this thing that's more than the sum of the parts. When any organism comes into being when it self-organizes. There's a thing more than the sum of the parts that comes into being that can't be found in any of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
You can feel it. Like if I had you stand up in front of a room and I said, oh, say your name and your social security number and your phone number and your weight and your height and your age and all of that stuff, nobody would really know anything about you.
Right, right.
However, there's this feeling that you give off, that people have a sense of, that they know as Mike, and it's got a unique flavor or texture to it. That's that thing that's more than the sum of the parts that comes into being. Everything has it.
And this is feeling again.
Yes, it is. And this whole earth, the earth as a whole, it came into being as a self-organized system which regulates temperature, atmospheric content, on and on and on. And it's that thing more than the sum of the parts that is the whole system itself, that invisible thing. That's what Gaia is.
Okay. All right. What does Stephen think of homeopathic remedies? And as a side, I'd like to add to that, you know, what's the difference between homeopathic and herbal and holistic? Could you maybe do a little bit of definition?
Yeah, well, homeopathy, I haven't studied homeopathy a lot. There's some homeopathic remedies that I use that, you know, they work every time for colds and flu, for instance.
Uh-huh.
And they're really effective, so I know that they work. And but the thing is, it's, you know, very popular to bash homeopathy now, especially in England. There's a huge kind of uproar going on about it now. And the thing is that in homeopathic remedies, they start off with an herbal tincture just like an herbalist would, but they dilute it down so there's very, very little in that thing. And there's a big argument now about how much is really in there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the thing that most people, the detractors, don't understand is that if there's even one part per million, one part per trillion in there, that's enough to cause significant physiological shifts at the macro level in a human being. And that's how plants work, and many ecosystem interactions, endocrine disruptors, tend to be really active at, you know, just a few parts per trillion.
Mm-hmm.
So I talk about that a lot in Lost Language of Plants, for instance. So I think there's a firm foundation for homeopathy. And then, you know, herbs are different. You're taking a whole plant system into yourself. And holistic, that's a whole other thing. You know, I've trained in psychotherapeutic modalities, in physical therapies, and in contemplative spirituality over the last 38 years in all of those fields really intensely. And it took about 34 years for me to feel like that I'd learned enough to be able to truly call myself a holistic practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
Many people are alternative practitioners, are their natural healing practitioners. But to be a truly holistic practitioner, you have to be comprehensively trained in multiple psychotherapeutic disciplines, multiple physiological disciplines, and multiple spiritual disciplines to be able to blend all of those things together so that when somebody comes to you, you don't just see their psychological dynamics or their physical or the spiritual. You see
all of those things,
their interrelationship.
Right, okay. All right, you are a person who writes really nice poetry, actually, too. And I'd like to ask you about art in general and how you see that fitting into the puzzle and what sort of importance you put on it.
Art deals with the invisible all the time. I really think that the real thing facing us in our time is the reclamation of the invisible.
Mm-hmm.
That we individually and as a group begin to reclaim the invisible and to turn away from mechanical reductionism. And art consistently works with the invisible. And you know, a lot of art is terrible, and a lot of art is not. And like words, they say a writer's primary tool is words, that they work with words, but it's not really true. The primary thing a writer works with is meaning, and they have to learn how to inhabit the world, to inhabit the word, to pile up meaning behind the word like water behind the dam, and so that when a human being touches that word, the surface tension breaks open and the water or the meaning just flows out into them.
Mm-hmm.
So you're working with an invisible thing, and that's the function of art.
Mm-hmm. Do you play any music or anything like that?
I do play the guitar, and I actually sing quite a bit.
Uh-huh. You like to brew beer?
I have. I haven't been able to for a few years, but I did write a book on that, and I did brew for quite a few years.
Yeah, I've actually done it, too, and it was a lot of fun. But I'd like to ask you a question about it with regard to health, because I think that you've written a little bit about it in sort of a sacred manner, I guess.
Well, beer is a fermented food, and it's incredibly healthy for people, but it's been around for a very, very long time. I mean, one of the big lies that everybody believes is that indigenous people didn't have alcohol until the white men brought it and it ruined them and all of this. Every indigenous culture that I can find records of has, you know, a history of fermented beverages all through North America. Almost the only one that I can't find any evidence for are the Australian Aborigines. Everybody else did ferment, and they ascribed, it was a tremendously sacred process for them. They were working with the substance of the invisible while they did that. And I mean, their ceremonies, their acuity of perception, and their capacity to brew the most amazing things is really astonishing.
Huh. All right. Here's another one for you. Well, I guess this is a sort of a general question that a lot of people want to know. I guess just sort of advice. What do you think that people can do for themselves to help and heal themselves and then to help and heal others?
Well, it's, you know, that's a variety of the question I get asked the most, which is, how do you go on in the world with things the way that they are?
Mm-hmm. Knowing what you know.
Yeah. And, you know, Alda Leopold said that one of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives in a world of wounds. That's a true dynamic. So all of us have to deal with those things that we find in the world. But again, the primary number one most important thing I found is to follow your feelings. Like when you're walking in a natural ecosystem and you're walking along, and there will always be a time where some tree or some plant or some stone will capture your attention. It will seem more special than the others, and you'll feel this kind of feeling, like maybe you'll just breathe in, or you'll think, gosh, that's beautiful, and you'll want to walk over and spend some time with it. That's the way the world gets people to re-inhabit their inner being with it, and that's the way human beings begin to find their way on their own life path. Those moments where you're touched by something, there's, from time to time, there's those touches that are extremely strong, like when you happen upon the Grand Canyon when you don't expect it, or these amazing events that happen that have this tremendous physiological feeling to them. And I call those things golden threads, the touch of a golden thread, like that story I told about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You could feel something when I repeated the words that woman said about their dying, you know.
Yeah.
There's this feeling that becomes present, that the body recognizes a deep truth as it emerges, and that's what I call the touch of a golden thread. And following those things, we all will find our way home to the place we're meant to be. We'll find our way to the work that we're meant to do, and that work, that soul work that's there for us, that is our ecological function in this lifetime. That is the healing work we're meant to do.
But you have to be conscious in order to recognize those things, right?
You have to be conscious enough at least to notice the difference of feeling that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back on, you know, I mean, I was incredibly stupid and uninformed and ignorant when I was 16 and left home. But nevertheless, the one decision I made was to follow that feeling wherever it led.
Mm-hmm.
And that I could do. And I have met very, very few people who cannot.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. All right, you've been in New Mexico for a little while now. How are you liking it?
I love New Mexico. It's great. This is where Silver City, New Mexico, is where all of the old anarchists, hippies, earth firsters, and everybody else that didn't fit into the boxes of life came to live.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's great.
And you've got a place sort of in the outback there?
Actually, we've got a place on the edge of town, a really huge 4,000 square foot adobe house that I've been working.
Awesome.
I call it ensouling habitation. It used to be a woodworking shop, and I'm turning it into kind of an art gallery home, kind of was what it feels like. And then we have some land about 14 miles up the road from here, 80 acres up in the Gila Wilderness.
Wonderful.
Really nice, yeah.
All right, what do you got planned for the coming year?
Well, I'm doing an apprenticeship next year. I do one every 3 or 4 years, and that's what I'm doing then, and mostly being around here, finishing the house and teaching that, and then after that, I'm going to start writing again. I got a few books on the in the works.
All right. Well, I will say thanks, and if you got anything you'd like to close with, just go ahead and do that, and then we'll talk another time.
Well, it's so late, I can't think of anything to close with.
That's plenty, I guess. Well, it's been great, Stephen, and you do great work, and you know how much I appreciate what you're doing. And like I say, the listeners love you, too. I got all kinds of great notes and emails and responses coming right now. So
thanks.
And we'll be in touch. And if you've got information on your apprenticeship that's coming up, maybe shoot me a line about it or something, and I'll get it up on the website.
On the website.
Okay, so sounds real good, okay?
Okay, thank you, Mike.
You take care of yourself, all right?
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Stephen Herod Buhner on the web, www.guyanstudies.org. Stephen's great, and I hope you all appreciate some of the things that he had to say tonight, okay? Okay, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 12:25. Now on the 25th of December, 2007, Christmas morning now, just 25 minutes or so into it. Merry Christmas to all you out there who are celebrating Christmas today. And I think we'll play a piece of music here, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit and see what else we got in line for you for the rest of the program, okay? All right, everybody, it's Mike, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Once again, this is The Starlings. All right, that's Alaskan Fire from the Songbird CD. The band is called The Starlings. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And it's about 12:30 now on Christmas morning, December 25th, 2007. Hello, everybody, and thanks for listening. I'd like to say thank you to everybody out there who is participating in the program. Hello to everyone there in the chat room and all the people that have been listening to the program tonight. And thanks to Larry Norger for helping me out on the website. Take a look over there at MikeHagan.com, and you'll have access to everything that we're doing. And let me know what you think about it, okay? There's a discussion board, bulletin board, forum, always fun, interesting stuff going on over there. Live chat up and active tonight. Hello to everybody over there. And some funny stuff going on in the chat room tonight, as a matter of fact, and as it should be. I encourage my guests as well as listeners to join us in all these different modes of communication, all right? My email address, speaking of that, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio at AOL.com, the website www.MikeHagan.com, and the phone number here, and in fact, we'll do that. I'll open the phone lines here if anybody wants to call and talk. We've got an hour and a half left of the program, and I really don't have anything too structured planned for that rest of the program. We can do space weather, talk about a few things that are in the news. I'll start taking a look around on the web, see what I got to come up with. But if you'd like to, you can give me a call here, and we can talk on the air as well. The number is 573-443-8255. And I'll be glad to chat with anybody that has the gumption, okay? Now, in the meantime, let me tell you a little bit about some upcoming guests. Next week on the program for New Year's Eve, we'll have Paul Laffley, one of my favorite guests. He's an amazing artist and architect and visionary futurist and just a remarkable intellect and human being. So we'll have Paul Laffley on with us next week, probably for the entire program, including the music of the Hoot and Hallers next week. It'll be great stuff, some live music in and out throughout the program next week. And I'll feature some other stuff from their new CD called Friends. So that's next week on the 31st of December. The following week, Jonathan Zapp back with us on the 7th of January. That'll be fun. And the 14th of January, we're scheduled to have a woman named Patty Taylor. She's a doctor, and we'll be talking about healing again, but sex as well. David Abram, the author of Spell of the Sensuous, one of my favorite books that I read a long time ago, will be on the program sometime in the next month or two. And Michael Heisen, Dr. Michael Heisen, and Star Newland will be back on the 21st of January to talk with us about whatever they're up to over there in Hawaii. And again, always fun to have Michael and Star on the program. So we'll keep things rolling along into 2008. And, you know, just keep our eyes on the skies like we always do. Who knows what's coming? I've had intuition that there have been, you know, big things happening, you know, right now. But, you know, so far, seems like sort of status quo. Beautiful things happening up there in the heavens, but so far not translating down here on planet Earth, as far as I can tell at least. Anyway, we'll find out soon enough. Always just pay attention. Gordon Wasson, Robert Gordon Wasson, the anniversary of his death on the 23rd, yesterday, December 23rd, 1986, R. Gordon Wasson passed away, moved over to the side of the ancestors, and we always say thanks and hello to people who have contributed a lot to things that I'm interested in or helped me learn things, and Gordon Wasson was certainly one of these people. He and his wife, of course, Valentina, encountered Maria Sabina, the amazing Mazatec shaman, back in the early 1950s, and they were initiated into the sacred mushroom ceremony, the sacred psilocybin mushroom ritual, which was still being practiced by some of the indigenous people in South and Central America, in Mexico. And Maria Sabina, some people think that she should never have shared it. And others say that, you know, she was a hero and a, you know, a saint for doing exactly what she did. I tend to put myself in the latter camp. I think Maria Sabina was a remarkably visionary woman and realized that one of her contributions to, you know, the West would be the reintroduction of the populations in the North to the mysteries of the psilocybin mushroom. At any rate, Gordon Wasson sure found it a remarkable experience, wrote about it in, was it 1955, I don't know, in Life magazine. Maybe it was later than that, 1957, I'm not sure. But it was called The Magic Mushroom of Mexico, I think, and that's a Life magazine issue that if you can find one, it's worth putting in your collection. At any rate, Gordon Wasson went on to become a famous mycologist and spread the word in many different languages and in many different ways about the mushroom, not just the visionary mushrooms. He was very knowledgeable about, you know, mycology and fungus in general, and he was a real great spirit and somebody who contributed a whole lot to the things that we're interested in today. So Robert Gordon Wasson, thank you, my friend. Appreciate everything you did for us. Passed on the 23rd of December, 1986. Okay, let's play another piece of music here, and then we'll come back and, I don't know, do what? Play this one. Come back, do a little space weather, I guess, okay? It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. that song called Gold Dust. Once again, the band is called The Starlings. And the CD we're listening to tonight is called Songbook. You can find information on the web about all of the musicians that I feature on the program at www.mikehagan.com. Just go click over to the music archives. The Starlings, I think, are on the web at www.starlingsmusic.com. And they've got the MySpace thing and all that, too, as well. All right. It is KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. The show is called Radio Orbit. We do this every Monday from 11 p.m. until 2 a.m. And we've got another hour and 15 minutes of the program tonight. We'll see what we come up with, but right now let's do a little bit of space weather, okay? There is, some funny stuff, actually. I was a little bit behind the curve. Some of the people in the chat room are talking about some interesting solar prominences that are showing up on the sun tonight. It's actually sort of a joke. They came up in the shape of Santa and his reindeer. But actually, the sun's sort of quiet right now. Not a whole lot going on. And, good night for Santa and his sleigh to be cruising around the world delivering gifts to all the lucky children. I say lucky because it's not just the good children. If it were the good children, everyone would get something. You know, there's a lot of good kids out there that don't get anything. So anyway, it's the lucky children, I guess, or the lucky people. Maybe not lucky, I don't know, whatever. If you're interested in that sort of thing, NORAD is tracking Santa and his sleigh across the planet. And right now, it appears that Santa is in, Western Europe somewhere. Better get moving. I don't know, maybe I'm not reading this thing right. Go to the map here. Where's Santa? Aha. All right, there's where Santa is. Now I got it figured out. Santa's actually in Colorado Springs right now. So, if you look up in the sky and you see something interesting there, well, maybe it's Santa and his reindeer. I was hoping to see Santa in a different sort of sleigh this year. Something more futuristic. Something of the round spinning variety or something like that. Alas, not yet. All right, space weather. If you want to put a mark on your calendar, the 29th of January, about a month from now, there will be a pretty good size asteroid that is very likely to strike the planet Mars. And there's a larger one that's going to be flying past our own planet. This asteroid has been dubbed 2007 TU24. It's only going to be 1.4 lunar distances from our planet. Now, that's one lunar distance is about 250,000 miles. So 1.4 is another, 100,000 miles. So 350,000 miles plus or minus from the planet. That is close, you guys. I mean, that is really close. Now, of course, they always add the caveat. There's no danger of a collision, but the 400-meter-wide space rock will be close enough to photograph through backyard telescopes as it speeds through the constellation Cassiopeia. Anyway, man, anything that's that close can be perturbed. And, if it gets too close, it'll get sucked in here to the gravity well, and then you never know what happens. So, anyway, a couple of interesting asteroids flying by in the next 30 days or so, all right? Like I say, not much going on in the sun, at least not on the side that we're observing right now. And, we'll just have to keep our eye on it. The sun's always changing, and there have been some pretty remarkable things happening in the last couple of weeks, but very quiet right now. All right, what else do we have here? Near-Earth asteroids, we talked about that a little bit. Well, space weather, the best thing to do, in my opinion, for things cosmic of that nature, is to hop on the web and go over to Kent Stedman's website at cyberspaceorbit.com. He's always following all kinds of interesting things on that website about, things in the astrophysical realm. All right? Okay, and spaceweather.com, of course, I use them a lot for much of this information. Let's see, the phone number, once again, is area code 573-443-8255. Give me a call if you want to talk about something. If not, I think I'm going to just play some music for a little while here. I've got a little bit of a cold still, as I typically do this time of year. And anyway, just going to chill out a little bit, I think, for the rest of the program and enjoy this Christmas Eve. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is a song that's called Take Me to the Fire. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Radio Orbit.
Good night. Thank you.
KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. That's the Starlings once again. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It is just a few ticks before 1 a.m. now on Christmas Eve, or Christmas Day now, I guess, the 25th of December, 2007. Hope you have a nice day, and if you have plans, be careful out there driving around and whatever it is you're doing today, okay? And if you have kids, well, hope you have a real nice time with them, okay? Well, I'm going to probably just put on some music and let it roll here for a few minutes and then sign off, because the young woman that does the program after mine is not going to be coming in tonight. I've got things that I need to be doing at home, actually, stockings to stuff and that sort of thing. And if I can sneak out of here an hour early, I think tonight's the best night to do that. So I apologize for bugging out on you early. If you were expecting the full 3 hours, you only get 66% tonight. But you got an hour and a half with Stephen Herod Buhner, and that's a powerful thing. So I hope you all enjoyed the program, and we'll finish off with some more music from the Starlings. I don't know, we'll probably play for another 10 or 15 minutes here while I get things wrapped up. But I won't be talking to you anymore after this. So, like I say, enjoy the night and have a great week. We'll come back next weekend, or next Monday, I should say, on New Year's Eve with Paul Laffley. Should be a pleasant, should be a thrill to have Paul back on the air, okay? All right, everybody, thanks for listening, as always, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care of yourselves.
Make a big